Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for November's Orthopaedics Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce our speaker for today, RCVS recognised specialist in small animal orthopaedic surgery, Duncan Barnes. Thank you, Duncan. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you very much. Hello and welcome to this webinar on small animal fracture assessment and planning. For the uninitiated, it can seem unclear why ostensibly similar fractures, such as these three tibial fractures shown in the radiographs on the screen, have been treated in different ways. In this webinar, we will look at the information that is used to assess a patient with a fracture, and we will then look at how this assessment is used to formulate a range of treatment plans and then decide which one is our plan A. Finally, we'll look at a couple of common fractures and their assessment and planning. The first thing to consider is the signalement of your patient. The single most important factor is the age of your patient, which will have a marked effect on expected healing times. Species is also important since there are differences between both the pattern of fractures that we see and the ideal treatment options between cats and dogs. It is also useful to consider the normal lifestyle of the patient in determining the demands which will be placed on your repair and the most appropriate form of fixation. As orthopaedic surgeons, it's really important that we don't just see the fracture and decide that we must fix it. We must always consider the rest of our patient and check for more urgent, life-threatening problems. Our assessment should always start with a really thorough clinical history and examination. Common problems seen in traumatised small animals would include shock, head trauma, thoracic and abdominal injuries, and diaphragmatic and body wall ruptures. All of these conditions should be specifically ruled out and a thorough assessment of the patient made. In this dog, with a shown in the radiograph here, we had a femoral fracture, but there were also significant pulmonary contusions which were treated conservatively until he was safe to anaesthetise. Anemia is also a common problem which should be ruled out in animals with fractures, and especially cats, where the hemorrhage into the local tissues around the fracture can result in a significant anemia without evidence of external bleeding. The history and examination should also include an assessment of the patient's health prior to the injury. Some conditions such as cardiac and renal failure may affect the ability to anaesthetise the animal safely, whilst others such as hyperadrenocorticism or hypothyroidism might affect the expected ability of the patient to heal. Finally, the history should be carefully assessed for indications that the bone was abnormal prior to fracture. These femoral radiographs of a 12-year-old greyhound, which sustained this simple oblique fracture whilst out on a walk. Such a history of minimal trauma leading to fracture is highly suggestive of a pathological fracture. If we look carefully at the radiographs, we can see that there's cortical thinning and lysis within the distal femoral metaphysis. And this was a dog which had an osteosarcoma in the distal femur. When a patient is brought in as an emergency, an abridged history is adequate to establish the situation and provide triage for that animal. A more thorough history can then be taken once the patient has been stabilised. Similarly, the initial examination is focused on identifying major life-threatening injuries. Careful assessment of the fracture can occur later, along with repeated examinations to assess for late onset problems, which should then continue regularly over the following days. Such late onset problems include cerebral edema, body wall rupture, and pulmonary contusions. And this is a dog which has got some fairly marked pulmonary contusions, as indicated by the red arrows. These injuries can be seen even more clearly on the CT scan, and we can see that there were indeed five broken ribs on the right hand side and some pulmonary edema associated with that, which we can see on the right-hand image. When examining fracture patients, it's a good idea to remember that the spinal reflexes in animals in shock and those with metabolic derangements or hypothermia may be profoundly obtunded. It is therefore important not to decide such patients are deep pain negative until they have been adequately stabilized. On the other hand, animals with spinal fractures might not be identified where there are also fractures to the bones of the hind limbs. This cat was referred for the treatment of a pneumothorax, and we can see that clearly on the radiograph. However, careful assessment of the entire radiograph reveals a fracture luxation with a small residual step at between the fourth and fifth lumbar vertebrae. There is also an incidental finding of a fused L2 and 3 vertebrae, which is probably a congenital abnormality in this cat and of no clinical significance. Looking for these changes really stresses the importance that we really must check the whole of our radiograph and not just focus on the most obvious lesions. I'd also recommend that we extensively clip any areas of bruising or edema in a traumatized patient. This allows us to make a much more thorough assessment and to allow much better monitoring of the health of the soft tissues. Some of the things that we'd look out for, particularly in traumatized animals, are umbilical bruising, which always raises the suspicion that there may be some intra-abdominal hemorrhage. And also, if we see extensive bruising or swelling in the inguinal and perineal regions, this will make us look for and really want to rule out either pelvic fractures and/or urethral trauma. The cat in the picture here was an unfortunate little guy who'd had a urethral rupture which had gone on undiagnosed for 3 days prior to being referred. And this led to this very extensive slough of skin over the perineal and abdominal region and necessitated a really significant and costly wound reconstruction. An important part of our clinical examination prior to imaging is to assess the degree of soft tissue trauma that has occurred. A variety of grading systems can be used to assess the degree of soft tissue damage associated with a fracture. And this can range from the soft tissues being completely intact to complete loss of the soft tissues, which we would see in a shearing injury. The degree of vascular damage to a bone and surrounding to soft tissue has a really important bearing on the healing times and the prognosis that we expect with a fracture. We therefore try to distinguish between bruising and devitalized tissues. It will be necessary to continue to assess those soft tissues and their vitality over several days following trauma. And it's important to warn owners early on that further soft tissue loss can occur, even if everything looks okay at your initial assessment. Nerve function is also extremely important and should be assessed thoroughly. This is often limited due to the fracture and the ability of the animal to move the leg in a normal way, and really initially is limited to the assessments of the presence or absence of sensation in the limb distal to the injury. Even when there is evidence of neurological dysfunction, it is usually necessary to perform orthopedic repair prior to recovery of nerve function. But it's important to warn the owners that recovery of nerve function will not necessarily occur. This is most often seen in animals with either pelvic fractures affecting the sciatic nerve or distal humeral fractures with radial nerve involvement. Neurological function is generally expected to recover, though, in the vast majority of these cases, except where we can see that there's clear transection of the nerve. But those cases are pretty few and far between, and most of the time we would go ahead and treat the fracture. Having identified the major clinical problems, the patient should be stabilized, and that's really a subject for another talk, until they're in a fit state for further diagnostics to be performed. So, the mainstay of our actual fracture assessment is going to be radiography. All traumatized animals should have thoracic and abdominal radiographs performed, along with a ventral dorsal radiograph of the pelvis. This cat that we can see in the radiographs here had this very obvious distal femoral fracture, which was the lameness that the cat had was attributed to. But the clinical examination didn't pick up the fact that there was also this pelvic fracture because the cat was pretty angry about all of this. Missing such pelvic fractures can lead to long-term problems with pelvic narrowing, and this can lead to constipation or obstipation in the most severe cases. And it's also going to clearly lead to a less favourable outcome if we try to repair the femoral fracture but don't deal with the pelvic issues. So we should take orthogonal views of the affected limb, which are necessary to really fully characterize the fracture. And I'm sure we've all seen situations where you take orthogonal views, you can't see the fracture on one view, but it's very clear on the other view. We should also take orthogonal views of the contralateral limb, which will allow us to make a comparison where the lesion on the injured limb is subtle, but it also facilitates the templating of the fracture to determine the most appropriate implant. Type to use and the size of the implants that we're going to need. In the case of ligamentous injuries or physeal fractures, stress views can be again really helpful to get an idea of what's actually going on there, with sometimes them having a normal appearance on the standard view, but then the growth plate opening up when we do a stress view. Finally, the use of radiographic contrast studies of the bladder should be considered whenever there's suspicion of urinary tract trauma. Sometimes we'll go beyond radiography and use computed tomography, and this can be a really invaluable tool, particularly for more complex fractures or fractures which are involving more complex anatomical regions. And the most common ones that we'd be looking at are pelvic fractures, spinal fractures, and fractures of the carpus and tarsus, which often turn out to be considerably more complicated than they appear on radiographs. Finally, we often use ultrasound, and we would use this in most traumatized animals. And this is a good way to rapidly assess the thorax and abdomen for the presence of major injuries. For example, this image shows a sagittal plane view through the abdomen of a cat, and we can see the thickened bladder wall with a small amount of fluid within the bladder and free fluid within the abdomen surrounding it. And this is the result of a rupture of the bladder. And this was confirmed by performing biochemistry on the fluid drained from the abdomen. So, having got all our diagnostics done, we can now go on to planning the fracture repair. So, having dealt with the other issues, such as getting the patient stabilized, I like to use this flow chart to help me decide on what should be done next. The first question to ask is whether or not the fracture is repairable. Most fractures are repairable unless there has been significant bone loss or complete loss of the neurovascular supply to the limb. If the fracture is repairable, the next question is to ask ourselves whether or not it's within our capabilities to repair it. And if it isn't, then we should perhaps consider referring it on to someone else. If it's not repairable, then in some situations, a salvage procedure might be an option, such as a femoral head and neck excision or a total hip replacement, or potentially an arthrodesis. If it's not repairable and a salvage option isn't available, then we should, in those cases, consider whether amputation might be the best option. So, having decided to repair the fracture, thorough planning is a prerequisite to a successful outcome. The first step is to determine what kind of approach we're going to use. And so these two pictures express the two ways that we can go about a fracture repair, and that's either to be a carpenter or a gardener. And so when we are using a carpenter approach, we're trying to put the bone back exactly in the shape that it was originally. Whereas when we're taking a more gardener approach, we're really focusing on using the body's natural healing ability to get the fracture healed. And so when we look at these two photos, we can see that there looks like there's quite a lot more planning involved in the gardening than the carpentry here. So when we're taking a carpenter approach, the aim is to precisely reconstruct the bone back to its original shape. This generally requires an open approach with direct reduction of the fracture fragments and internal fixation to achieve interfragmentary compression. The Carpenter approach is a good option when we're treating articular fractures, such as this acetabular fracture shown in the radiograph, but it's also very good for humeral condylar fractures as well. In practical terms, reconstructing the bone is difficult to achieve when there are more than three fragments, and so we tend to reserve this for situations where there is are three or fewer fragments. Importantly, if we are going to consider attempting a carpenter approach, it's generally not possible to change partway through to being a gardener, since the surgical dissection that we need to reconstruct a bone completely will generally mean that the fracture hematoma and the vascular supply to the fractured bone has been disrupted. So, alternatively, we can use a garden approach where the aim is to maximally preserve the biology of the fracture callus and particularly the vascular supply to the bone. The emphasis is placed on aligning the joints proximal and distal to the fracture without directly reducing every fragment back to its original position. This is commonly used to treat comminuted fractures, but it's also suitable for treating more simple fractures like this minimally displaced spiral fracture in the tibia of a young dog shown in the radiographs. Biological osteosynthesis makes the most of the body's own healing process and is best applied with minimally invasive techniques. And so this would include minimally invasive plate osteosynthesis, which we used in this case. In that situation, what we do is we make a small incision at the sorry, let me grab my arrow at the top of the bone and another small incision at the bottom of the bone. We slide a plate up along top of the periosteum and then use a few screws at either end to hold that in place. And this allows us to really avoid interfering with the fracture hematoma itself. When this is not possible, an open but don't touch technique is preferable, in which an open surgical approach is made without disturbing the fracture callus or attempting to reduce every fragment. So, in this next section, we're going to look at how we go about assessing the biology of the fracture. So, a number of factors should be considered, and it's useful to score these as good, medium, or poor. All the biological factors are then assessed together to provide an overall biology score of good, medium, or poor. The first factor to consider is the age of the animal, with animals less than a year having a good score. Animals which are geriatric will get a score of poor, and that will obviously the age at which that cutoff occurs will be a little bit subjective and vary between breeds and individual animals. And all the animals in between are scored as medium. So, next we consider the soft tissue prior to the injury. Some regions of the bone have lots of muscle surrounding them with an excellent blood supply, such as the scapula shown on the left here, and we'd give a good score to that. Some regions have inherently poor vascularity and minimal soft tissue coverage, and these would include the feline distal tibia and the distal radius and ulna of the dog, which we would then give a poor score to. We also want to consider what the soft tissue is like after the injury, with closed fractures receiving a good score, and open fractures with soft tissue loss, such as the shearing injury in this poor cat here, receiving a poor score. We also need to consider what the soft tissue is like following our proposed approach. So, using a minimally invasive approach, such as normal grade pin and external fixator on the left, a good score is given. Whereas if we're using an open approach, such as the case on the right here, we're much more likely to have a medium or poor score as a result of the disruption that we've caused to the soft tissues by our approach. It can also be a really useful thing to consider the fracture energy. So simple undisplaced fractures, such as the tibial fracture on the left, will have a lot less vascular damage and impairment than the high energy, highly comminuted fracture on the right, which is expected to have significant vascular disruption and has much worse biology. The presence of an open fracture also leads to worse biology, with recent open fractures with minimal contamination getting a medium score, whereas open fractures with more established infection are clearly going to get a poor score. Finally, the general health of the patient should also be taken into account, and any pre-existing conditions, such as the hyperadrenocorticism of this guy, which could influence healing, would lead to a worse biology score. So we take all of these individual biology scores and make this into our overall biology score. This will give us a rough idea of the expected healing time for the fracture, with good scores leading to rapid healing times, less than 8 weeks, whereas fractures with a poor biology score are expected to take greater than 16 weeks to heal, and fractures which have a medium score having somewhere in the middle. The longer the expected healing time, the more the fatigue resistance of the selected implants should be, because they're going to have to be taking the brunt of the weight-bearing forces for a lot longer. And so fractures with worse biology scores are expected to be at a greater risk of infection or non-union. And certainly we should consider bone grafting to help stimulate more rapid healing and improve the biology in fractures where the biology score has been poor. The next section in this webinar, we'll look at how we assess the biomechanics of a fracture. Again, we want to get an overall score of good, medium, or poor by scoring each of the individual items on this list. The first thing to consider is what the patient's size is. And rather than big being bad and small being good, what we find is that actually at each end of the spectrum, we can find it biomechanically challenging. And so very small or very large patients, we would usually give a low score, whereas most of the animals in the middle, where we have good sized bones and implants to suit that, will get a good score. It's not necessarily just about the size of the bones, but sometimes it's also about the size of the forces acting on them relative to the bones. And so if we have a staffy such as this bodybuilder, we can see that there are very large muscles on relatively small bones. And again, this is going to be a much more ch biomechanically challenging situation than a sort of standard Labrador. Fractures which can be reconstructed, we will generally give a good score, whilst comminuted fractures are going to receive a poor score. This doesn't necessarily reflect how well they're likely to heal, it just reflects how biomechanically stable they are in themselves. Again, if we have patients with a single limb affected, we will generally give them a good score, whereas if we have multiple limbs affected, then obviously that's going to make things considerably more challenging because we find that the animal's not going to be able to take the weight off the repaired bone as it would when there's a single bone. The ability of the reduced fracture to load share with the implants, such as the transverse fracture on the left, will also reduce the stress on the implants and lead to a better biomechanical score. The presence of an intact paired bone, such as an intact ulna when we have a radial fracture, or an intact fibula when we have a tibial fracture, will also markedly reduce the loading of the implants following a repair. The involvement of a joint leads to a worse biomechanical score for a couple of reasons. Firstly, it means that the fracture is inevitably at the end of the bone, which reduces the amount of bone stock that we have available. And secondly, because the involvement of the joint necessitates perfect apposition of the fracture and the use of a carpenter approach. And so that's again a more biomechanically challenging situation. Finally, when we're assessing the biomechanics, the amount and quality of the bone stock should be considered. As well as the closeness of the fracture to the end of the bone, the amount of bone stock is also determined by the thickness and quality of that bone. This in turn then influences the ability of the bone to hold implants. The less bone there is for implant placement and the poorer the quality of that bone, the worse the biomechanical score is. We then get our overall biomechanical score, and this can help us to determine both the approach which we're going to take, but also the degree of construct rigidity that's going to be required. The construct rigidity can be modulated by changing the implant size, by changing the material that the implants are made from, i.e. between stainless steel or titanium implants, and by choosing between implants of different geometry. Further modulation can be achieved by combining implants, either as plate and pin constructs or external fixator and pin constructs, and potentially orthogonal plates, where plates are placed on the bone at 90 degrees to each other. So having assessed the biology and the biomechanics of the fracture, it's also useful to consider the forces which are going to be acting on that bone. The major forces that we're going to be considering would be axial compression, rotation or torsion, bending, both in the sagittal plane and in the frontal plane, as shown here, and shear, as the fragments try to slide past each other. Sometimes in particular fractures, we also need to consider distraction. So this is most commonly important in avulsion fractures, such as tibial tuberosity avulsion fractures, where there are large muscle forces trying to pull the fracture apart. So these forces may be partially resisted by the fractured bone, depending on the configuration of the fracture. So different configurations of repair will then resist these forces to a greater or lesser extent. And together, the bone and the implants create a construct which must resist these forces long enough to allow bone healing to occur. So as far as these tables are concerned, what we're looking for is for the sum of the resistance offered by the bone and the repair to add up to three pluses in each of these columns. And we'll come back to this table later on when we look at some examples. Before deciding which form of fixation to go for, it's also necessary for us to consider some patient factors such as temperament, their ability to rest or to tolerate something like an external skeletal fixator. We also want to consider owner factors such as their expected compliance with the instructions they're given, their financial limitations, which is often a major consideration in a lot of situations, but also how well they're going to be able to cope with any potential complications that could occur. Finally, a surgeon, we must consider our own capabilities, the equipment available to us, and our own ability to cope with any complications which might occur from our chosen fracture repair technique. So we come finally to formulating our plan. It's helpful to consider both the biology and the biomechanics, as we discussed, and the use of a table such as this can be helpful. External coaptation is generally best only considered in animals with good biology and good biomechanics. Similarly, external skeletal fixation is not ideal in patients with poor biology, since the extended healing times necessary are likely to make the maintenance of the fixator difficult. So the last part of this webinar, we're going to have a look at some case examples. So for case number one, we have Scout, and Scout is a 12-week-old whippet, and we can see her here on the left as she makes her way to the vets in a buggy. Robbie on the right is uninjured and quite happy. She has been lame for about 24 hours following a collision with the washing line. She has a very compliant owner, who happens to be my mother-in-law, and a good insurance policy. Other than a swollen, floppy and painful left antebrachium, she's in excellent health, and no other abnormalities were detected on her clinical examination. So we went ahead and admitted her and got some radiographs under anaesthetic of both the left and right antebrachia. And these revealed that there was this fracture here. So if you'd like to take a moment to have a look at that. So we diagnosed in SCOUT a minimally displaced complete spiral fracture of the radius and an oblique fracture of the ulna, both of which are within the sort of mid-diaphysis of each bone, affecting the left antebrachium. So first of all, we're going to assess the biology of this situation. And so generally speaking, everything's looking pretty good from a biological point of view. So her young age, the intact soft tissues, which are inherently good in this part of the antebrachium, the low fracture energy, and the absence of an open wound, and her good general health all score good in biology terms. In addition, in a dog of this age, just 12 weeks, with a minimally displaced fracture, it's very common for the periosteum to be intact because it's a really sort of tough fibrous membrane at this age. And this provides a rich source of bone healing cytokines as well, and also a really good vascular supply to the fractured bone. So overall, our biology score is most definitely good. When we consider the biomechanical score, the patient's size is not too small, and the fracture is reconstructable, and only one limb is affected. The position of the fracture in the mid-diaphysis also means that there's plenty of bone stock available. The only concern here is that the spiral oblique nature of the fracture means that the bone will not fully share the load with any implants used, but there will be a degree of load sharing. So here we have put our cross on the table, and so we would feel that overall the biology and biomechanics of the fracture are both good. So the fractured bone itself is not completely unstable, and so when we consider how it's going to resist some of the forces acting on it, we see that it will resist axial compression to some extent, torsion reasonably well, and also distraction is going to be very well resisted, but due to the pull of the extensor and flexor muscles and their tendons around the antebrachium. The poorly resisted forces are going to be bending and shear. So have a think what your plans A, B, and C should be. And even if you have a clear idea of which one you would select, it's good practice to always consider how you go about alternative options, since unexpected developments during surgery might necessitate a change of plan. So, for me, repair option A at the simplest end of the spectrum is the use of external coaptation, and this is certainly a reasonable option. It's likely to be the least expensive, and although this is not always the case, once multiple bandage changes have been performed, and possibly multiple sedations have been needed. There's also a moderate risk that if the puppy tries to wriggle out of the cast or splint, that further displacement of the fracture could occur with subsequent malunion. There is also a risk of cast-associated soft tissue injury whenever we use external coaptation, and young sight hounds such as Scout are particularly prone to these. It also requires a degree of aftercare and compliance of the owner with your instructions, which could be challenging in some situations. But this would generally not be my first choice, and we can see that this is not Scout, and that was not the way that we treated Scout's injury. And so, where we can use implants, I would generally prefer to do that. So, repair option B is the use of an external skeletal fixator. The fracture shown in this radiograph was obviously not Scout's, and was clearly much more distal, with a very small distal fragment. So external skeletal fixation is a good option to repair Scout's fracture. Application of the implants in a closed fashion would make this a minimally invasive technique with good preservation of the good biology that's already there. But it does, however, require a moderate degree of aftercare and a second surgery to remove the frame. And some dogs, and particularly puppies, can find external fixators somewhat cumbersome. Furthermore, the pin track complications are common, and the post-operative period is a little less straightforward for the owner. And when the owner's your mother-in-law, that can be very important indeed. So finally, we have repair option C. Application of a plate to the dorsal aspect of the radius, ideally using minimally invasive plate osteosynthesis technique, where we just make a small incision at the top and the bottom and slide the plate in underneath the skin and above the periosteum, would be an excellent option for the repair of Scout's fracture. So using this minimally invasive plate osteosynthesis technique really preserves the biology of the fracture, and there's minimal aftercare requirement. So the outcome is predictably excellent, and the long working length of the plate and the locking screws that we used here mean that we get a degree of micromotion at the fracture site, which will again tend to encourage healing of the fracture. And so that's what we used in Scout's case. Here we see the radiographs taken just 3 weeks later, and we can see that both the radial and the ulnar fractures have healed very well and with minimal callus formation. We can see also that the bone has continued to grow, so the plate is further away from the growth plates. So if we look at the table again, we can look at the three repair options that we've considered. And we can see that when we add up the the pluses in the fractured bone column with each of the individual repair options, we can see that each construct is adequate to resist the forces acting on the fracture. So we would therefore expect healing to occur with any of these techniques. However, other factors such as the reduced aftercare requirement and reduced potential for postoperative complications make the plate repair my first choice in this situation. And here we see Scout a few years later enjoying her full active lifestyle along with their best friends Robbie and Jack. So for our second example, we meet Hattie, a 5-year-old domestic short hair cat weighing 4 kilos, sorry. She has a non-weight bearing lameness of the right hind limb following an RTA which occurred 2 days before. She's been successfully stabilised and has been found to have no other significant injuries. She's in good health and is well insured, and finances are not a concern. And when we examine the right hind limb following extensive clipping and cleaning, this reveals a small puncture wound where one of the pointed bone ends has punctured the skin from the inside and then gone straight back in again. And no bone is currently visible, and there's no evidence of an established infection at the fracture site. So again, she is admitted and she has radiographs taken under anaesthetic, and here we see the right tibia. These reveal that there's a complete and this time highly comminuted fracture of the distal tibial diaphysis. The fibula is also fractured, but there is no involvement of the hock joint. So when we assess the biology of Hattie's fracture, we find that the picture is much less rosy than it was with Scout the Whippet. So whilst she is not old, she is not under a year, and so rapid healing is not expected. The region of bone affected is known to have a poor inherent vascularity, and this warrants a poor score. The fracture energy must have been high to generate such a lot of comminution, and again, this is likely to have further reduced the vascularity of the bone fragments present. The presence of an open wound also suggests that the fracture site is contaminated and that infection could be starting to develop. The only positive is really her otherwise good health. So taking all of these factors into account, the overall biology score must be medium to poor. The picture is a little better when we're considering the biomechanical situation with a mixture of scores. So on the positive side, she's a good size. She has only one leg affected and the joint is not affected. On a negative side, the high degree of comminution means that there will be no load sharing between the bone and the implants, since it's extremely unlikely that reconstruction of this bone will be possible. In Hattie's case, the fracture is not too distal, and there is a reasonable amount of bone stock available for implant placement. But in some feline distal tibial fractures, the bone stock can be a major problem. Finally, the fracture of the fibula makes the situation a little worse again. So overall, Hattie's biomechanical score, I would say, is medium. So this is where I would put this fracture on the grid. From this, we can see that we need a really robust fixation that's going to have good fatigue resistance, since healing time is expected to be fairly prolonged, and it also needs to take all of the weight-bearing forces during much of the early period of healing. And when we consider the ability of the fractured bone to resist the forces acting on it, we can see that the bone itself is going to contribute very little resistance to those forces. And so this means the implant's going to have to do all the work until fracture healing is well progressed. So when considering the options for the treatment of Hattie's fracture, I'd firstly rule out external coaptation, because this is very likely to lead to a non-union of this type of fracture. So repair option A for me would be an external fixator. This is reasonably good option, and again, ideally should be performed closed to maximally preserve the biology of the fracture site. This is actually Hattie's fracture repair, and so unlike my effort here, I'd avoid opening the fracture site and applying cerclage wires. The major problems with using an external skeletal fixator for a fracture like this is the fact that the healing is expected to be slow, and this means that the frame will have to stay on for a long time. This increases the chances of pin track complication and pin breakages, and however engaged the owner is at the beginning of this fracture repair, the ongoing management of the frame that's needed tends to become increasingly frustrating as time goes on. It can also be difficult to decide the exact timing of frame removal, since the fracture may appear well healed radiographically, but be prone to refracture either through regions of poorly healed bone or the pin tracts. So, as I say, in Hattie's case, an external skeletal fixator was used successfully and the fracture was healed at 9 weeks, as we can see in these radiographs. And this allowed us to remove the remaining parts of the frame and leave the cerclage wires in place. External skeletal fixation remains an excellent option for cats with distal tibial fractures, which are infected or where there is a significant shearing injury. And if the fracture extends very close to the tibiotarsal joint, then the external fixator can be placed across the hock joint as a transarticular fixator to provide additional stability during healing. However, external skeletal fixation would not be my first choice now for a cat like Hattie. In this very similar case, radiographed at 12 weeks following earlier removal of some of the implants in a destaging procedure, we can see that there is a non-union of the fracture site. This is a complication we see in a relatively significant proportion of cats with distal tibial fractures treated with external skeletal fixation. This was successfully revised by excising the bone ends to try to remove the non-healing part and applying a medial plate with a lot of bone graft at the fracture site. So we could consider using a medially applied plate as our initial treatment for Hattie's fracture. And this is repair option B, which we can see here on a similar kind of fracture. When using a medial plate, it's really essential to contour the plate very, very carefully and to pay very close attention to achieving correct alignment of the stifle and hock joints. The plate can be applied in either a minimally invasive fashion or using an open but don't touch technique. The major difficulty is that medially applied plates in this situation are rather prone to failure due to bending, as we can see in the cat here with the middle radiograph. Use of a relatively stiff plate is therefore essential if attempting to perform medial plating only, to provide sufficient resistance to that bending force. This case was successfully revised with the addition of a new medial plate and the addition of a cranial plate to create an orthogonal plate construct, as we can see in the right-hand radiograph. And so repair option C for Hattie could have been an orthogonal plating as an initial treatment. For me, this is the best option available and provides the most reliable healing. The radiographs in this slide show the use of orthogonal plating in a similar case and shows good progression of healing at 6 weeks in the radiographs on the right. The fact that each plate is protected by the other and is being edge loaded means that the bending forces, as well as all the other forces acting on this fracture, are very well resisted. The placement of the cranial plate also helps to improve the alignment of the bone, and if placed using a minimally invasive plate osteosynthesis technique, using craniomedial incision at the proximal and distal end of the tibia, this can be a surprisingly minimally invasive technique despite the quantity of metal that's being implanted. Some surgeons may be nervous about using plates in an open fracture. The fact that the fracture is open does increase the chance of an implant-associated infection, and this could necessitate the removal of the implants after fracture healing is complete. However, for most type 1 open fractures, such as Hattie's, infection does not occur, and the increased stability and improved bone healing afforded by this technique mean that healing is much more likely to occur, which again would make it much more straightforward to then remove the implants later on down the line. An alternative to orthogonal plating is to combine a medial plate with an intramedullary pin, as shown here. Again, the addition of the pin significantly improves the resistance of the construct, particularly to bending forces, and helps to align the bone fragments during plate application. The major difficulty with this technique in cats is the narrow size of the tibial isthmus, the point at which it narrows the most, and this limits the size of the pin that can be used. It can also be difficult to get the screws past the pin. This is significantly easier when using a locking plate since many of the screws can be monocortical. So, as we can see from this chart, all three options discussed are reasonable, but the use of orthogonal plates provides the best resistance to all the forces acting on the construct, and for me would be the option of choice for Hattie. So, for cases with orthogonal plates, the lack of a need to remove the implant also means that any delayed union is very rarely a problem and allows us to allow the cat to confidently weight bear during its convalescence period. So, in summary, the keys to successful fracture repair are to carefully assess the fracture, its biology and biomechanics, as well as other patient, owner, and surgeon factors. And by using this information to create a thorough plan, A, B, and C, one can achieve reliable outcomes across a range of fracture types. Thank you very much for attending this webinar, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have. So we do have a question which has come in. Let me just open this. So, for me, minimally invasive plate osteosynthesis, are you happy must you use locking plates? And are you happy to leave plates in place in young dogs as long as as not close to the growth plates? So for the first question, we don't have to use locking plates for MEPO, so it's certainly perfectly plausible and possible to use a non-locking plate, such as a dynamic compression plate when we're doing MEPO. Obviously, as with any time that we're applying a plate which is non-locking, we have to compress the plate accurately onto the bone, both at the proximal end and the distal end where the screws are. But the bit in the middle, which is bridging the region of a comminuted fracture, for example, certainly doesn't need to be in close contact with the fracture fragments. And certainly, I've used non-locking plates in MEPO many times with perfectly good results. With regard to the second question, am I happy to leave plates in place in young dogs as long as not as they're not close to the growth plates? Yes, so obviously different surgeons will differ in terms of their preference for removing implants. I typically don't remove implants unless I have a reason to do so. And so the reasons which might cause me to decide to remove implants would be irritation from the implants after the fracture's healed, particularly if there's loosening of one or more screws, that would be a cause to remove them. Sometimes with particularly antebrachial or distal tibial fractures. The plates can be close to the surface, and that can seem to cause a degree of reactivity, particularly when the weather is cold. And so again, that would be a situation where we remove them. And any cases where we get a sort of an infection, we would be looking to remove them in that situation as well. But on the whole, no, I don't tend to remove them in any patients other than that. And I wouldn't treat young animals differently in that situation. So I've had another question through. Do I take radial plates out of tiny dogs as a concern about the plate causing stress protection and potential subsequent fractures? So when I have a distal radial fracture in a toy breed dog, for example, we would routinely use a plate to repair that, and we tend to use locking plates in that situation. When we have those cases as a primary repair, what we tend to find is that they generally heal fairly reliably, or very reliably. And I think one of the keys to those cases is getting those dogs to weight bear nice and early on. It's really unusual for your unless you're using a really enormous plate for the there not to be load sharing between the plate and the bone. And I would say my opinion is that actually it's much better to encourage the dog to do more exercise, which will load the bone more and therefore reduce the chances of bone atrophy than it is to take the plate off. And certainly there's a reasonably high rate of refracture through the screw holes if you remove the plate routinely from dogs with distal radial fractures. I hope that answers that question. So I'll just wait a few more minutes for any further questions.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Duncan for an excellent webinar today. The recording and certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.